Welcome to CounselorAudioSource.net. Counselor Audio Source is a weekly podcast dedicated to the professional enhancement of practicing counselors, supervisors, and counselor educators. Look for us on the web at CounselorAudioSource.net. I'm Dr. Marty Gensies of Kent State University, and joining me today on Counselor Audio Source is Dr. Jason McLaughlin, also of Kent State University, and we'll be having a conversation about some of his work regarding how to address clients who are suicidal. With me today on Counselor Audio Source is Dr. Jason McLaughlin, who is an assistant professor at Kent State University. And today, Dr. McLaughlin is going to be speaking with us a little bit about suicide and research as it's associated to suicide. Jason, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Why don't you give us a little understanding of the current state of suicide in the U.S.?
Well, the current state of suicide, really, if you look at how statistics has been gathered, one is there's a underlying problem with how we gather statistics on suicide. We really think of suicide as collected by usually coroners and things like that, medical physicians. But a lot of times what happens is that it's not reported as a suicide. It's rather reported as something else, of maybe an accident or something like that. So really, the statistics we have in terms of suicide is underrated. But what it looks like is, at a rate of about 1 in every 17 seconds here in the United States, someone attempts suicide. Now, there's an issue with that may be a lot more, just because we don't know exactly what the statistics say in reality. Now, one of the things is when we look at a longitudinal look at suicide, we think of really the rate of suicide has been pretty steady over the past 50, 60 years in the United States. When we look at the overall rate of suicide, that's for young folks, older folks, adults, whatever it might be. When we take a closer look at that, specifically recently, we see some trends in who is trying to kill themselves, and we really focus on those populations. One is, for the past probably 20, 30 years, there's been an issue with older adult suicide. Folks are 60, 65 years or older, that because of possible health problems, life situations, whatnot, suicide is really climbing for that population.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes a lot of sense, just because as we get older, if things start to decline physically, because physical condition is really a good risk factor for suicide. So that plays that physical kind of deterioration plays a lot in there. The question mark we have for suicide now is really for youth suicide, because that's really on an incline.
Hmm.
We think of youth suicide in specific populations. One, and this is coming out in the literature more recently, is folks that are gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered folks. Those are really a huge population for younger folks that are coming out either to friends or may want to come out to family, things like that. That population is just really on the incline for suicide. When we break it down into with ethnic groups, certainly folks that are African-American urban populations are certainly on the increase, and a variety of things like that. So really we focus on the youth suicide, the elder suicide, not discounting the adult suicide, but those are the two kind of pockets of populations that are certainly on the increase.
Not to minimize the suicide by older folks, but is that sort of, I mean, do they see themselves as the suicide as being more related to kind of a decision to euthanize themselves?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question, because one of the theories of suicide is it's an option. It's simply something of, I want to get rid of my pain, I want to get rid of all the things going on in my life, I might want to not be a burden on my family anymore, so suicide might become more of an option. Mm-hmm. So that euthanized kind of thing is there.
And with that, I'm trying to get a sense of the difference between the two populations that you described the rise in, the elder population with the physical issues, and then the younger population that are dealing with what kind of things? You said LGBTQ issues.
Is a big part. Yeah. Is a big part. But you know, as we grow in society, the one thing that stays constant is folks that are, you know, 12 years old, 15 years old, 18 years old. Main thing one is peer support.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the contributing factors to that is if you're considered kind of an outcast, you might have some things that you may not feel comfortable or may not feel connected mm-hmm. with other folks. That peer support thing is a big factor there. So when you think of the contrast between elderly folks and younger folks, it's more of that connectiveness
mm-hmm.
or that maybe more appropriately the kind of outliers and that lack of support that really focuses on younger folks.
Yeah. Are you seeing folks who some chronicity to it where folks are multiple attempts?
Yeah, that's one thing that the literature really doesn't talk about this a lot, but I've seen a lot in practice where there will be almost a chronic suicide or kind of a chronic suicidal personality that someone may attempt at one point, that doesn't succeed, mm-hmm. they may attempt again. Typically what will happen is the more attempts will happen, the more severe it gets. And that's really something that we have to, as counselors, we have to look at in terms of treatment. Assessment and treatment is really that area that we
need to look
at.
So with more attempts, the lethality gets, they right. take a more lethal means?
Correct. Usually how it would work is they either would repeat the same means and maybe try to do it, quote-unquote, better.
Okay.
Or they might try more severe means. But one of the big risk factors with suicide is prior attempts.
Mm-hmm.
So you think of, you know, the more prior attempts they have, the more likelihood that something might actually be completed.
Mm-hmm. So I know every class I teach, generally one of the students will bring up, you know, master students, well, what about mm-hmm. suicide?
Right.
I mean, I can be teaching basic counseling skills.
Right.
And it seems to be an issue that is creates a great deal of anxiety, a great mm-hmm. deal of concern, I think rightfully so, for students. So what do we need to be teaching? How do we need to be handling this in terms of the new counselor trainee?
Right. You're exactly right. One of the things that also the literature shows is that for counselor trainees, suicide, dealing with suicidal clients is one of the most scary things that they have to deal with.
Hmm.
That's one of the things that it provokes fear within themselves, provokes anxiety about being sued, about, you know, how is this going to deal with my career in the future? Can I emotionally handle with it? All these different things. And the way that I usually approach folks, I teach an advanced appraisal class. And what I do in the advanced appraisal class is I give a very realistic view of what suicide is like.
Mm-hmm.
I do role plays in class where usually I'm the client
mm-hmm.
just because, you know, I might have a little more insight of what these different kind of
mm-hmm.
clients might be like. I'll scream at them. I'll cry in front of them. I'll do a variety of different things that I'll hang up on them. If I do a role play where the counselor's on the phone and I'm mm-hmm. calling in, I'll say I'm killing myself and hang up the phone. So I think the more realistic we can provide students real-life situations, the more prepared they'll be in the field of counseling. I think also the issue of talking with our supervisors about how to work with these younger counselors on not only, you know, what's the appropriate risks assessments, what's the appropriate treatment modality, but really how can they deal emotionally mm-hmm. with their own kind of inner ugliness, if you want to call it that. Because mm-hmm. when you talk about suicide, there's kind of the legal things, there's the ethical things, there's also the moral things that I don't think a lot of folks get into in terms of training folks to deal with counselors.
And by moral, you mean?
Moral is kind of the individual kind of thing. Like, for example, you have a person who is 75 years old and they're dying of end-stage Bowden cancer and they have 3 months to live.
Mm-hmm.
Well, is it right for them to kill themselves because really for the next 3 months they're going to be in horrible pain?
Mm-hmm.
That's a decision really that no one takes a stance on. In fact, really the ACA, APA, social work group, all those folks really have not taken a stand on are counselors supposed to deal with those type of issues. Mm. Really, the only group that has said really anything would be the social workers, and they said it's up to the individual clinician. Mm. As long as we don't help them in that act, there's really no set way on to do that. So that's really a moral or individual kind of decision to make as a counselor on really what should we do here, how do we prevent, should we prevent, those kind of end-of-life issues of how do we treat.
And I can imagine for the counselor in that position, that's pretty scary kind of feel that you're having to wrestle with these moral issues often all by yourself.
Right.
And for the counselor trainee, I would imagine that's just an overwhelming experience in terms of trying to figure out how to wrestle with these moral issues.
Certainly so.
Is there a piece about that new counselor trainee that you see that kind of, and you said we need to talk more about it, but with the counselor trainee sort of looking at their own values around death and around suicide, that's helpful.
Mm-hmm. I get into a couple discussions with folks, one talking about their own religious values, mm-hmm. how religion plays into how they look at suicide. There was an interesting study, actually, I just read a couple days ago that looked at religion and counselors and how they view suicide. Huh. And what it said is that the majority of folks, this number might be wrong, but I think it was somewhere around 80% of very devout Christian counselors will view suicide as very immoral, abnormal psychopathology. This mm-hmm. is an evil event. This is damnation kind of issues. So when you deal with those religious issues, you get in discussions with students about really what can they think of and how can they keep an open atmosphere about, here's a certain point in someone's life where they're in a tremendous amount of crisis. How can you help them get through this?
Well, at the same time, I can see that as being a dilemma for an instructor because you're opening up a whole sort of moral can of worms when you're saying
you should
lighten up on this. This is, you know, and people kind of take that very personally in terms of their own religious values.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I think that's in several points in counselor education. I think that comes about when you teach folks how to be non-judgmental. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody's got their push button kind of thing. So I think in that same light of how do we teach folks to be non-judgmental is in the same light of how do we teach folks to kind of keep this open premise about suicide. And
yeah,
and
I see
like
that come up also with LGBT issues, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered issues. It pushes a lot of moral buttons for folks, and it's hard to kind of wrestle with that accepting non-judgmental piece and also with your own internal spiritual values around those issues.
Yeah. So. But I think, and I've talked to you before about this, is I think that's an important part of their education, though. Mm-hmm. And if they're going to be pushed or strained or things like that, kind of looking at themselves in different ways, I think those are important parts to, parts to look at.
So, legal, ethical, and moral issues related to things like right to die, and do you have any ideas about those?
In terms of ethical things, I mean, we look at all the codes of ethics, APA, ACA, all those have issues of we have a duty to protect, we have a duty for confidentiality, those type of things. So those are the legal areas. One of the legal things that I stress in my class when I talk about suicide is how to document. Also part of the ethical part is also how to document as well is there's a way to document, there's a way not to document. Is there something of you're documenting too much? Are you documenting in the right way that really conveys the true essence of what your client is talking about? And usually I talk about the first thing you do is you always use the words of the verbatim words of the client. You document that you assessed, you document how you assessed, you document that you consulted, and also what's the actions that the supervisor told you to do. Because typically in legal cases, when we go into kind of the world of malpractice, typically if you've consulted, that's seen as a very positive thing in malpractice suits. One issue is in reality, not a lot of folks actually get sued for suicide. It is on the increase, but when it actually comes to trial, the main thing is that documentation has to be there.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So those are the kind of legal protections that you suggest counselor trainees do.
There's a good book.
And we can put the resource. We can put the resources on the show notes page. So as you talk about things, we'll make sure we have it on the show notes page for listeners.
Okay. There's a good book. Suicide Over the Lifespan.
Mm-hmm.
It's an ACA publication, and Ted Remley wrote a good chapter in there, and he talked about specific ways to document, specific language to talk about in terms of suicide. Just a very good chapter on that.
So how should we train folks? You've talked about the new trainees and the issues they're dealing with. Are there ideas you have from a program level in terms of what you could be doing larger in programs across?
Well, one is, I think we're doing a good job at training folks now, but I don't know if we put it into context. Really what the literature says is the things that counselors need in terms of treating suicidal clients are things that we teach them in basic procedures course.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a lot different other than kind of staying calm and things like that. But what the literature shows is the things they need is empathy, positive support. They need those relationship skills. They need to know how to keep boundaries. Really, those if you think of those four Lambert kind of common core things that change folks in therapy, those are really the things that emerge as positive things towards treatment with suicidal folks. So I think in those basic procedure courses, when we're teaching things about empathy and building relationship skills and things like that, I think if we put those into context of suicide, it might make those kind of new folks in counselor education programs think of this is how this might relate to suicide. Since suicide's just the big scary thing that maybe the big pink elephant nobody wants to talk about.
Yeah, and I think maybe people see it more as okay, when somebody starts talking about that, you switch into you kind of forget all your good counseling training and you come up with some magic that you're going to address it with. And what you're saying, one of the core pieces of the magic are those basic counseling skills and relationship building skills.
You're exactly right.
With folks. So assessment. I know from teaching psychopathology, there's the PIMP and the PLAD and there's all these types of quick little assessments for doing that.
Right.
What kind of things can we or should we be doing with assessment?
The one is, Jerry Junkie said that there's really three parts that go with assessment. The clinical interview, a good empirical-based suicide assessment like paper-pencil test, and then consultation.
Hmm.
The consultation part, you know, we talked about that, you know, you document that and you talk with your supervisor and whatnot. The clinical interview, how I view that is there's really two ways you can go about that clinical interview. One is the PIMP model or the PLAD model. The PIMP model is prior attempts, plan, intent, means, and prior attempts.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the quick, dirty, easy way. And those are really those four things, plan, intent, means, and prior attempts. Those are really the four key factors that you look at for suicidal risk factors, specifically that intent issue. That's good for like crisis hotlines.
Mm-hmm.
That's good for, you know, if your client is coming in and you know, you see them act very erratic and like a big change in behavior and things like that. That's one thing that PIMP or PLAD model is pretty good for. The other mode, other than the PIMP and PLAD model, would be a more extensive interview that would talk about things such as degree of emotional pain, like perturbation is what it's called, of how much inner pain can they deal with. Most importantly, how much pain do they have, but how much more pain can they take? Is it someone that, you know, I've asked folks, you know, how much pain are you in? And they've said, oh, you know, I'm in a lot of pain, but for me to get to suicide, you know, there'd have to be all these kind of catastrophes that happen. I've had other folks that said, you know, if my husband burns the toast one more time, I'm killing myself. So that's how much emotional pain are you in?
So the gap between where they are and where the outcome,
right,
the suicide outcome might be in
exactly
terms of their
right.
emotional pain.
Exactly right. So that perturbation issue is one. There's an issue of kind of emotionality in suicide. The big emotional factors are depression, worthlessness, helplessness, hopelessness, loneliness. And then you think of these diagnoses that are really important with suicide, schizophrenia, kind of dual diagnosis, substance abuse issues, you know, some personality disorders, narcissistic personality, borderline, these type of things. So there's a diagnostic kind of component in there. There's also an assessment that needs to take place in this kind of longer assessment that deals with what are the life stressors, what are the family supports, what are these kind of issues of hopelessness, and a variety of other things that we can really dive into that really talk about suicide on a much deeper level, which is really more important for clients that you'll see on a continual basis. That's not in this kind of situation where it's an emergency room or you need to triage folks. But it will provide the clinician more insight as to where is the client at right now, but more importantly, how likely are they going to kill themselves in the future.
Okay.
So it's more of an in-depth issue.
So a client comes in, you have the relationship, you do an assessment, or you start this assessment process, and you kind of determine this client is at risk of suicide. How do you treat? What do you do at that point, is it?
Well, it comes in a variety of different ways. One is if you have a client that comes in and they're highly suicidal, and usually how we define highly suicidal is, for your best clinical judgment, they're going to kill themselves within 72 hours unless somebody intervenes. That's highly suicidal. At that point, you'd think about hospitalization. You'd think about some pretty intensive treatment and things like that. If you have folks that come in and they're talking about kind of this chronic suicide, or they've thought about suicide, they're kind of a low moderate lethality level, where they've always kind of got this underlying kind of feeling of, you know, killing myself is always an option. There's things that we can do in treatment that can help them either not kill themselves, but also kind of negate those bad feelings. And really, there's a couple ways that the literature will say that we need to treat those folks. Is one, if you have folks kind of this kind of low-grade suicidality, one is really focusing on the preventative factors. And that's even how suicide assessments are almost turning in this way of how do we assess these preventative factors. We have a variety of different assessments called these reason of living inventories that provide folks with an understanding of, you know, I've got good support, I've got, you know, some good backing at home, my relationships are good, I'm worthwhile in these areas. So focusing on those preventative factors or those reasons for living is really kind of the hallmark or cornerstone of that treatment process. One of the things when you talk interpersonally between the client and counselor relationship, one is letting the client know that you and the client are on this journey together. That one of that big connective piece between you and the client of letting them know is, you know, you're there as a resource. You're here to provide more resources. There's help out there. That encouraging, not kind of a cheerleader kind of issue, but more of you're there on a pretty intimate level with clients that you're kind of long ride with them. That shows in the literature that's a very good relationship or a good preventative factor with suicidal clients.
So you're kind of presenting yourself as collaborating with them around that particular experience that they're having right then.
Correct. And that relationship is really one of the things that sparked the whole issue of no harm contracts. You know, sign this paper, make me a promise, and, you know, therefore you won't kill yourself. Well, that's been a lot.
Does that work?
You know, the literature is wishy-washy on this. Personally, I think one is if you're using it in terms of protecting yourself in a malpractice suit, legality, that doesn't do anything. It's not going to do one bit of good. One, it's not a 50-page document written by lawyers, so it's not something that's going to be really beneficial in court. The benefit is a relationship benefit. And for me, it doesn't necessarily have to be on paper, but it does add another level to this. For example, if I have a relationship with a client and there's a good amount of trust built there and we do have a pretty good therapeutic relationship, if a client promises me something, that's kind of what that no harm contract is doing. It's kind of like they're promising something, they're signing it, so it almost makes it feel more official. So there is a therapeutic benefit that they're making a promise to their counselor. Now, legality-wise, it doesn't mean anything in my mind.
Well, you, my experience with this has always been in settings where it's been crisis in nature.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you talk about if you have a good standing relationship with the client,
yeah.
It's like for me the relationship has always been about 5 minutes long.
Right.
You know, I haven't had sessions of relationships. And so I think that's a particular struggle and maybe a fear that a lot of counselors have, that somebody's just going to come in, yeah. Sit down, plop in the chair and say, here's at it. This is, yeah. What I've got, and you don't know me and I don't know you,
right.
and here's the story.
Right.
I guess one strategy, and maybe you can school me on this a bit. One strategy I've always used was to take it from a systems approach.
Mm-hmm.
Who else can I bring into the picture?
Yeah.
Because there's no way I can be with you 24/7.
Right.
So I've always worked with clients around this in sort of a collaborative, in a collaborative fashion, but mm-hmm. also to see if there are other people in the system that they can have as folks to help them go through this piece.
Exactly, exactly. And that's one of the things that I talk with students about is you want to create a resource tree.
Mm.
And for each client, even if you see them for 5 minutes, this takes 30 seconds to do, I always have a resource tree of suicidal ideation. And that resource tree consists of 5 actions and 5 people.
Hmm.
The 5 actions are things that they can do on their own to try to eliminate these suicidal thoughts, try to feel better. First thing might be, you know, you take a walk or, you know, you listen to music, something like that. Create that individually with the client. If each one fails or they don't feel like doing those, the next step is that 5-person resource tree. Mm-hmm. You would always be the last person on that resource tree.
Mm.
They'd go through 4 other sources, and those could be a lot of variety of different things. One would be suicide prevention hotline. It might be calling their sister, neighbor, brother, whatever it is.
Mm.
Before I put those names of family members down, I do want to get a little insight as to, you know, is Cousin Earl the one causing this crisis? You wouldn't want him on your list.
Yeah, or calling the girlfriend that broke up with you that's causing this crisis is not on your
list. Yeah, not on your list.
Yeah.
Yeah. So creating that kind of 5 actions, 5 resource kind of tree takes 2-3 minutes max.
Okay.
So not necessarily having that relationship there if you're seeing them for 5-10 minutes, something like that, but letting them know that once they leave this office, there is things for you to do, empowerment kind of action things,
yeah.
And then there's things that there's help, there's resources out there that they can go to.
Yeah.
But that systems approach is a wonderful thing to do, just because a lot of the big factor with suicide is that loneliness issue. I don't feel like anybody can help me. I don't feel like there's any help for me out there. Well, there's going to be some help, and it may not be things you think about.
Yeah.
You know, the dog jumps on your lap. That's sometimes. I've had a client that I had a client that was incredibly suicidal just throughout his entire life. And the one thing that made him not think about suicide at all was his dog would come over and sit by him.
Uh-huh.
Well, when you hear those little nuggets, those priceless things in counseling, make sure Fido or whatever his name is around.
Yeah.
So those kind of little things in counseling.
What ways can you connect with Fido over the next couple of weeks that'll help you stay connected?
Right. Hmm. Right. That makes sense.
So treatment, I think, you know, as I said, I've had folks that have come in and been suicidal, and it's for me, it's kind of clear the schedule.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to spend some time with this individual, and we're going to work on this issue until we feel that some network has been established or we've made some decisions around the assessment in terms of what level of care they're going to need.
I think that's really the thing, if you talk about counselor education, that's one of the things that we need to instill in folks, is you really do clear the schedule.
Hmm.
Because I've had several clients come in that says, what about suicide as a manipulation tactic? you know, I have all these clients that come in and they have all these personality disorders and they're coming in and all they want to do is be hospitalized or things like that. Well, the thing, clear schedule. I don't care what they have. If they're talking about suicide, to protect yourself, to protect your clients, mm-hmm. clear your schedule. You want to set those boundaries to a degree, but at the same time, there is some kind of cry for help there.
Yeah. And even if it turns out to be a manipulation, that's not a place that you want to experiment with.
Right.
Okay. So continued care for folks after mm-hmm. that assessment at what levels? What kind of things go on with clients that have had a suicidal ideation or incident that you do in terms of follow-up?
There's really four points. One is continual assessment. The other thing is kind of working on this treatment plan. How can you grow? The assessment part comes in. You do want to continually assess. There's really four points in treatment that you assess for suicide. One's on initial intake. One's on discharge or termination of the client. So those are kind of the beginning and the end. But during counseling process, you'd want to assess at some level, and it's typically not going to be that PIMP model. It's going to be kind of a longer mm-hmm. assessment model that deals with if there's any drastic change in mood or if suicidal ideation comes about. A good book that was written in 1999 was by Jacobs. It's the Harvard Guide to Suicide mm-hmm. Prevention and Treatment. Wonderful book, and he talks in there about those are kind of the four places that you assess. So that continual assessment is one part. The treatment part, other than that assessment part, comes into of one of, like you said, bringing that systems approach, but almost bringing a systems approach on an existential level where it talks about how do you find meaning for yourself, but how do other folks find meaning in you as well? Because what we'd want to do on some level is take the client who's suicidal and have them understand that they have an impact on other folks as well. Now, they might not care about that, but at the same point in therapy, you'd want to at least have that mm-hmm. that kind of talked about and kind of ingrained in them at some point. The other type of things is a lot of times with suicidal folks, they'll feel like their entire world is very chaotic, mm-hmm. that they don't know what to do. They don't really have kind of a purpose in life. So one of the parts of treatment is providing some very specific goals and objectives on how to work on suicide, how to work on kind of thinking of life in a different way, if that's kind of the course of action.
So sort of a paradigm shift in the way in which they approach existence and non-existence.
Mm-hmm. Right. Hmm. When I see chronically suicidal folks over a time, those reasons for living inventories are a wonderful part, not just for assessment, but they provide good fodder for treatment.
Huh.
Because I've had clients before, usually these reasons for living inventories are like 30, 40 items long, they'll say, oh, you know, I never thought about this. This is a good thing. So those kind of things do play a good role. For treatment.
Now, I know you've done some writing, and you're currently working on a book around crisis suicide issues, right?
Correct.
Tell us a little bit about what writing you've done and where that's taking you and your sort of scholarship around this.
Yeah. I've written things for suicide, mostly of suicide and counselor education and supervision.
Mm-hmm.
How do we train folks? How do we supervise folks? A little bit on some basic skills. When we look at families, the last article I had was in the Family Journal mm-hmm. that looked at how do we look at families, how do we assess a family, specifically when you have one family member who's suicidal. So kind of the line it's taking me of in terms of my scholarship is how do we really think of suicide in a training capacity, one, but how can we help clinicians deal with suicide because it's such an inner moral kind of scary thought of mm-hmm. themselves. So that's kind of where my book kind of focuses around, is taking folks from, here's kind of some baby steps that you take on working with folks, and then going up to some more advanced skills and consultation type of issues. If a client does kill themselves, how do you handle that? Those type of things.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure it'll be well received, and we're going to put on the show notes portion of the website for Counselor Audio Source some of the citations of the books you talked about.
Okay.
And the articles.
Yeah.
That you've already produced around this work. Okay, you've given us a lot of information today, and I guess I would just like to ask you if there's something you'd like to do to summarize or share with our listeners before we finish the podcast.
Just to make it real brief, I think the one thing that I alluded to was there's that PIMP model of suicide assessment that you really use during triage or that's really time sensitive. But then there's also that longer model that's really a model that is more comprehensive, will provide you a lot more insight, not only for the current state of suicide your client's going through, but also some longitudinal kind of things. Mm-hmm. Could they be suicidal in the future? And what I've come up with is really what's called, taking off the PIMP model, is an acronym for the Simple Steps model. And the Simple Steps, it's a long acronym, but it is more complex than the PIMP model. Let me just go through that real quickly. If you spell out Simple Steps, the first, the S in simple, is suicide. Ask the suicide question. And the suicide question is, are you thinking of killing yourself? Are you thinking of suicide? It's not a question of, are you thinking of harming yourself or hurting yourself? Because that's really more of a question of, might mean suicide, but it also might mean other things like self-mutilation and things like that. So ask the suicide question. The next thing is ideation. And that ideation is really an important step, if not the most critical step, in looking at the thought processes of a suicidal client. Good way to ask clients if they're thinking of, or if they have some intent, is on a scale from 1 to 0, 1 being not likely at all or not at all, and 10 being extremely likely.
Mm-hmm.
How likely are you to kill yourself within the next 72 hours? And that's a question that will really give the clinician insight of how lethal or how much ideation this client has. The M in simple is method, really the means of killing themselves or the plan of killing themselves. What we look at there is the more specific the plan or specific the method and means, the greater the lethality. So if someone were to say, you know, I'm going to kill myself tonight at 4:30 and I'm going to go use a gun, that's a much more lethal method than, oh, you know, I don't know if I'm going to kill myself. You know,
yeah,
it might be
something. Or I'd have to think about which way I'm going to do this.
Right, right. So the more specific the method, the more lethal. Next is you assess that perturbation, like we talked about, that degree of emotional pain. But specifically, how much pain are they in? But more importantly, how much more pain can they take?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the L in the simple part of the Simple Steps model is loss. And this could either be experienced loss or perceived loss.
Mm-hmm.
Such things as, you know, you might have an adolescent that thinks that their parents are getting divorced or their friends are moving away. It mm-hmm. might not be what's happening, but that's something they we perceive. Or it's actual loss where, you know, they might have a relative die or a dog die or something
mm-hmm.
like that. That loss is a pretty big factor with suicide. The E in the simple is earlier attempts or prior attempts. What we look there is, as we said before, the more attempts someone has, the more likely they'll kill themselves. So that's the simple steps.
Mm-hmm.
And the steps part, starting with S, is substance abuse. All the literature would say that more substance abuse you use, the greater likelihood suicide will occur.
Because your inhibitions might be lower,
exactly.
You're a higher risk taker, things like that.
Right, higher okay. risk taker, you know, might be more impulsive, these type of things. Exactly right, exactly right. So that's substance abuse. Next is troubleshooting. What really the literature is showing now within the past, oh, maybe 5, 6, 7 years, are showing folks that the lower ability they have to problem solve or troubleshoot their problems, the more likely they'll see suicide as an option.
Mm-hmm.
So the more options they can kind of generate, the more alternatives or more kind of troubleshooting they can do, the more kind of positive outlook you'd have of negating suicide as a thought. So that's the ST. The E in steps is emotion. We talked about these emotional factors. The emotional factors there, again, depression, helplessness, hopelessness, worthlessness, loneliness. All of those are just very big emotional factors. And that's also, in addition to those emotional factors, those diagnoses that you really want to look at is any kind of mood disorder, schizophrenia, certainly, personality disorders you think of, and, such as borderline personality or narcissistic or antisocial, any kind of like anxiety kind of thing. Those diagnoses, that emotions are really factors that play a lot into suicidal ideation. The last two steps of this, in steps, the P part is parental, parental or family history. Really what the literature shows is the more kind of history someone has in their family, mostly maternal, but also some other, you know, certainly family kind of norms, the suicide in families does have kind of a pattern there. Where they might even see this as kind of a systemic kind of issue.
So the client might feel they, within their family system, they have permission to be able to kind of fulfill this outcome.
Right. Or, you know, Uncle Tom solved his problems this way, so now I see this as an option. Or just even as this is a way they handle conflict. Mm-hmm. And then the last step is, of the simple steps model, is stressors. Daily stressors, we look at, you know, what's going on in your life that leads you to thinking about suicide. What are the things that, you know, it's kind of the country song I always call it of my dog died, my job's gone, you know, my wife left me, you know, all those kind of major things in life that kind of attribute to life is not in a place where I want it to be.
So that's the simple steps method, and this is part of what you're putting together for your writing with the book.
Correct.
Coming up.
Correct.
Well, that's exciting. Having an opportunity to talk to you today about this, I've got a real respect for the way in which you're sort of scholarly approaching this whole project. It's been nice having this conversation with you sort of on this level. Our guest today has been Dr. Jason McLaughlin at Kent State University, and his topic was about suicide and working with suicidal clients. Thanks for being a part of this. It's been a real pleasure, Jason.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
You've just heard an interview with Dr. Jason McLaughlin of Kent State University regarding methods to address clients who are suicidal.
Look for previous podcasts, show notes, and listener feedback on the podcast website at counselaraudiosource.net. Listeners can leave comments or questions for our interview guests or hosts through our Skype.com internet telephone ID, Counselor Audio Source, or by calling 330-871-4015. Counseling techniques and interventions discussed in the Counselor Audio Source broadcast are meant for use by counseling professionals, and Counselor Audio Source is not held liable for any use of the techniques mentioned in the program. Our music bed today is Memorial Day from Jamie Beauchamp. His and other PodSafe music can be found in the PodSafe Music Network at podshow.com. Counselor Audio Source is licensed under the Creative Commons, a nonprofit organization offering a flexible copyright for creative work. Thank you.